Jay, and delighted to be here, and thanks so much for organizing this session. For those of you who were here in the first half, you saw two great presentations of a very comprehensive resource, and I'm going to try to take a slightly different tack and talk a little bit about our experience at Johns Hopkins with providing medical information, but speak more to the process. Also the challenges of adoption and trying to get people to use these guides in an effective way, especially in low resource settings, which was the topic of discussion here. I'm supposed to disclose that I don't think I have anything to disclose, and I won't have any off-label discussions of medications, but my guides are replete with off-label discussions, but I won't speak about any of them. So what I'd like to do in these 30 minutes is talk a little bit about the background of our project, some of the issues with using technology in low resource settings, and as I said, talk about the processes, and then finally end up with some challenges. Now you've no doubt aware, and you've seen lots of statistics so far about information overload. There's also great concern in many parts of the world, and certainly the United States, for reducing medical errors, and a growing emphasis to emphasize what we call evidence-based medicine, as opposed to sort of flying by the seat of your pants only, or your own experience. And unlike some of the some guides that tend to be comprehensive, our view was to try to do the top 95% and try to do that very well. So we probably won't have the most obscure diseases or illnesses, but we will probably have the things that are most common and challenging. And the idea that we had over 12 years ago was to try to organize it in a way that people would use the guide. So there's a lot of statistics out there, but for people taking care of patients or in engaged care situations, workflow is what people talk about. Will someone take the time to find something out? Someone comes in with a problem, they may or may not have a comfort level with that. Will they actually look something up or wing it? And this is just one of a large number of studies that have generally suggested that if you can somehow introduce something that's easily incorporated into the workflow of a healthcare worker, they'll more likely use it. And they'll also more likely use it if it's a recommendation and not just information that then you have to process and assess. And that if you could sort of do it at the time of that encounter, it's obviously going to be much more effective than if someone decides later in the day, well, I'll look up and see if I made the right choice or not. And so if you sort of do all those things, you'll more likely actually lead to some improvement. So what we've sort of done at the Pocket Center is to try to incorporate evidence-based medicine. We don't have our own staff to grade evidence. We rely on others, such as guideline documents or authoritative reviews in the medical literature. But we wanted to try to deploy this in ways that would be effective. So on the web, or when we started off, it was just on the Palm Pilot. Then came RIM and the BlackBerry, and you know the rest. It's gotten much more engaged and complicated, and there are new platforms coming out all the time. And we started off with the antibiotic guide merely because in the infectious diseases world, everyone needs this bug and drug guide. No one can really remember everything about that, unlike hypertension, where you sort of have your menu of a few drugs and you know a lot about those five or six drugs you typically use. But for infectious diseases, it's impossible. So when we first started this off, there was really no software that was available to really help us. So we developed our own database based on an Oracle platform, fairly expensive, $45,000 a year license fee. But it's a relational database that we could then organize and therefore use it to also deploy and publish new information on a daily basis to the web or to handhelds as well if someone were syncing their devices or if you had wireless syncing. And so this was a way we really wanted to try to lower the cost as well. you know, a traditional publishing house, you have a lot of people in between handling and shuffling papers. And we wanted something where if you had an editor, a writer, an author, and a peer reviewer, everything could be sent around without someone really in between that you'd have to pay to have them do it. So just by background, this software, which we ended up calling Tickler, mainly because we would tickle people to remind them to do the work by an email if they didn't get it done, is in this kind of format. And what I wanted to emphasize is we were originally writing for the Palm Pilot. I don't know if you remember, but the screen was even smaller than this. And what we told all of our authors is you only had 10 lines in a given section. You had to write so concisely, it forced people to really only put in what they thought was absolutely essential. And that, even though we've been much more liberal, there's now tons of memory on these devices, it's really been our mantra to try to hew to that so we can really convey information that people can find, understand effectively, and not have to wade through a lot of information. We try to make our authors and reviewers do that. So you can get a sense that we tend to use bullet formats, and this is the back end of the program, but I'll show you sort of the published version. And the other reason is workflow. I mean, we were passing around Word documents and got lost what version it was. And here we had an electronic marshaling of the workflow with stopgaps and publishing, because this is all peer-reviewed. We peer-review all of our information. And it allowed us to, I think, create a very good product that we could actually publish quickly. And of course, we can update this very fast. This is nothing terribly unusual. It's very similar to a Word function where you can have strikeouts and follow versions and understand what people have changed and edited, for example. So the antibiotic guide, which we started, and I'll back out in a moment just to give you an idea of this. We have over 680,000 registered users since 2000. And I wanted to sort of show you this and hopefully give you some idea of why this is a grassroots sort of success story. What we've done is we spend a lot of time trying to organize the information so that the users think that in this kind of fashion. So we try to organize things, for example, in bone and joint biodefense, for example, in diagnostics. We might have management sections, bacterial pathogens, vaccines, for example. Oh, now it's making me jump out. Sorry. I think we lost the web connection. So, for example, we'll, and you can see here how we have this written out here. It's very bulleted information, whereas we really don't try to be comprehensive. Clinical information is fairly discrete, sites where it controls, treatment, or again, where we try to cite an evidence basis for this and make it fairly shorthanded. I mean, we don't want to explain what retinitis is, but we figure the people using the guide will understand that that's an inflammation of the eye. We also, this is one of our favorite features here. you can click three drugs, and this is as if you were asking the doctor, a world expert, you know, what's your opinion of these things here? And, you know, it'll say something like works well, and there's one report of good success in cat scratch disease, for example, or azithromycin, sometimes considered the preferred agent, and it's the only drug tested in placebo-controlled trials. So we really try to give that this is a little less of an evidence basis, but more of an anecdotal information. And we have references, and we have our basis for recommendations, and we also include some information. And we don't really cite the literature that we think is most important, and then have a little comment about the relevance for it. So if someone really wants to learn more, we try to give them a Cliff Notes version of that. If we look at the vaccine areas, just something, again, influenza, which we end up updating regularly here, we have really just very basic information about the forms, the costs, the series, booster, and then adverse drug reactions. We really try to keep this very logical and clinically friendly. Instead of a lawyer listing everything, we really try to rate things that we think are important for people to know, and we don't go anything beyond common, occasional, and rare. So it really has some relevance to people. And then, so we just have this sort of organized in a logical fashion. And the reason for this, again, is so people can find and use this information in a very quick way. I think, unfortunately, every time I back out, I have to go back through here. So I apologize for that. So we have over 620 information modules, and it's organized in a way that we think most primary care providers or even specialists would consider figuring out the information. And here's the reasons why we think it's successful. One is we spend a lot of time on the information architecture. So when people look at our guide, they figure out how to use it, the first use or maybe the second or third use. It allows for very quick responses, so we have a publishing platform that we can update that day and publish at midnight every day. And some of the things that we've worked on very quickly, for example, go all the way back to the anthrax biohazard, biodefense problems in the earlier part of last decade, SARS. Influenza last year, we were updating regularly to try to keep people up to date, foodborne outbreaks. Drug shortages, an increasing problem in the United States and elsewhere where plants are closed down and they're the only one making a certain drug. New drugs, vaccines, and incorporating guideline information. But this is all background information. And you might say, well, this is good information. How important is it? And it's, of course, that's costly to try to figure out. We did do one study at the University of Maryland where we prioritized surgeons who we thought didn't always know a lot about antibiotic information to just usual mechanisms for obtaining antibiotic information versus using the guide, which they had on a BlackBerry. We gave them BlackBerries. And over a three-month period, there was a substantial improvement because they would actually look up the information and decide how to appropriately diagnose, treat patients compared to usual care. So we think this kind of strategy works. And because it was working very well, we then moved to a different guide, not so much an acute care guide. So the antibiotic guide is for acute infections. HIV, starting in the mid-1990s, became a chronic disease, more so than in the past because of the ability of medications to really limit viral replication. And this obviously has a much smaller audience worldwide, but still an important one. And this is a chronic illness and disease management guide that also deals with acute infections. And we started this in 2004. We actually built it and published it in 4 months using this software. So we could really write all this information. Obviously, it depends on people writing by deadline. But the point is, we could really move this around the editorial workflow very quickly and have a published product in 4 months. So this was, to us, a very effective way. And again, it's a very similar layout, and I won't back out to the screen at the moment to walk you through this. But this guide was around for a couple years and was well used in the United States, also globally. We have lots of users around the world. But as many of you know, under President Bush, there was the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, called PEPFAR for short, that sought to try to give HIV treatment to people in countries where they didn't really have the resources. And one of our partners at Johns Hopkins called JAPIGO got funding from a CDC PEPFAR grant to institute medical care in Zambia, a country that 1 out of 7 adults had HIV infection. The average life expectancy in that country is only 37 years old. And there were new guidelines being rolled out where Zambia was really at the forefront. They were using better drugs than the traditional drugs that were used in most countries around the world under the PEPFAR program. So they couldn't use the existing WHO guidelines. They needed their own set of guidelines. So here you have a country, Zambia. I don't know if anyone's been there, but if you've been in sub-Saharan Africa, you know there's limited resources. You're going to start a completely new medical program in this country. How do you convey that information to people there? And it's not just physicians. It's going to be nurses and also what's called educated lay people, because a lot of people there do not have, they don't have enough medical people to actually embark on care. So they're doing care in clinics after some rudimentary training. The other issue, of course, is if you looked at the guidelines, it was about 48 pages and no one reads guidelines. I mean, I don't know if any of you read, do you read instruction manuals when you get something? Not often, right? You just start using it and trying things out. So there were classes to try to educate people, but what kind of resource do they have? And paper guidelines, you know, they want something more durable, interestingly, because the paper degraded so fast. They also wanted ways where we could sort of provide it in different aspects electronically according to the setting. The other issue was the guidelines weren't written in sort of the way that we think were easily usable in a bulleted outline format of sort of prose paragraphs. So for those sorts of things that we worked together with them to try to develop what we called the Zambia HIV Guide. And it was done in cooperation with the health ministry there who had already authored the guidelines. And then once it was done, our job was to try to electronicize them. But the other concept we had was to integrate it into our HIV guide. So then they had this tremendous information resource, but it was completely adapted to make it relevant to the Zambian treatment setting. Because obviously some things in the United States don't translate to United States. And I want to show you how we decided to do that at a relatively low cost option, as opposed to writing a completely new guide just for Zambia.
Just for clarity, I'm sorry, did you say that they first are told what the guideline is, but then they're prompted to say that that drug is not available?
Well, it would depend how they were looking for the information. So I'm just saying we would, you know, if they went right to the guideline, they would have that guideline information. If they were looking at the drug, they would say the drug would be, this is the preferred drug for Zambia. Or if they were clicking another drug and say, well, I've heard about this one, maybe we should use this one, it would say it's not available in that country. So we really wanted to make sure that there wasn't just a lacoon of information in one section, and that if someone came at it from any direction, they would get relevant information for their country as well. So what I wanted to finish up with is to discuss a little bit about this project and how things went. These are just screenshots in case if we didn't have an internet connection. So we integrated the guidelines into our core content and then deployed it by both print in some versions, but mainly CD-ROM, also handheld devices, which were sort of these rough and ready kinds that were more durable than you usually find here, and also by smartphones, a Palm. And we rolled it out with a pilot smartphone, Palm, in the capital city, Lusaka. And then in more rural areas, we tended to use CD-ROMs on clinic computers. They usually would have one PC in a computer. Or if they didn't have a computer, they got a handheld device that they could then charge with a solar apparatus if there wasn't electricity in the village. So they would always have information. And this just is an example now from about 2 years ago, one of our Nicole Sokol there, who was working in Lusaka with one of the care providers in a clinic there and getting to use the information easily. And just to give you some idea of how this information was used here, interestingly, this is the first month of use. And so this was after initial uptake and so on and training. But found that of these devices, you can see here there was a range in the number of searches, how many taps it took for a person to get information. And then, interestingly, we also looked during non-clinic hours here, and there was also a substantial looking up of information even afterwards. So we felt like this was useful as well. People had questions that came up afterwards, and they still elected to look up information and perhaps change care. This is an idea of what we call point of care usage. We had these limitations, so it was only during clinic hours. And you can see here, people generally found their information between about three to five taps average, and got in and out of the guide within a minute in terms of following the information. So this was really our, and these are for people that were just sort of getting used to this kind of technology on the smartphone. User 6 obviously had a slower time. And then unique modules, you can just see, people really looked up a lot of information, which impressed us, on these smartphones. I mean, there were just really scores of modules generally looked up. And then even some of so-called, what we call the unique Zambia-specific ones, like pregnancy, TB, and malaria, were also viewed. These were just some comments from some of the providers. They thought they could see patients quicker. It made their work easier. It was easier to use than printed references because you could not only drill in, but also type a search item if you wanted. And they thought the information was well summarized. They liked that kind of bulleted outline approach. Now, adoption, this is where some of the keys. The smartphone was a toy. They loved it. It was what we call the gizmo factor. You know, they used it for making phone calls because it came with a phone plan. They put MP3 files on it for music. They brought it everywhere, but it became part of them, and they used it in clinic and at home. Now, in rural areas, there is no smartphone capability. The phone networks there are not sophisticated enough. But the single clinic, we had some electricity problems, but the handhelds ended up being the most durable kind of way to have this because you could always charge it. The problems were if they forgot to charge it and so on. That seemed to be most reliable. And even if there was a clinic computer, a lot of times it wasn't working. So the lessons that we learned were interesting, at least in this model, although the health ministry did a lot of the initial work to the guidelines during our review. We found a number of issues and inconsistencies, so we then worked back with the health ministry to improve the guidelines and reorganize it. So that actually went fairly well. We like to adopt it to the country-specific requirements. We tried to engage authors and pharmacists in country, but they really were not interested in it. So we really had to rely on using people there on the ground and interviewing them and getting information and then putting that back into the guide. And we really thought it was a way that seemed to really help strengthen this initial new effort in terms of providing HIV care in the country. I just wanted to, in closing, talk about a slightly different guide that we're doing now in Trinidad and Tobago with diabetes. Now, Trinidad and Tobago is in the Caribbean. They have some oil money, but they have an existing infrastructure there, including primary care and specialty care, very different than what you might imagine in Zambia. So again, they have a tremendous problem with diabetes and they wanted to improve that care. The adoption here is a little different. I mean, you're not rolling out a brand new program. You're trying to take existing care and try to improve it. And so far, we're just rolling this out. It's only been a few months, but we did a couple of things differently here. We actually could find people from Trinidad that were willing to write information. So these are names that people would know in country. So a lot of people use complementary herbs and medicines in Trinidad and Tobago. You know, they treat diabetes with Kurali root, for example. You know, I have no knowledge about Kurali root, but we found the leading expert there, and he wrote a very nice additional piece on top of our US-based clinical information that really made it relevant. The other thing was we're doing video teachings. So we'll take the national expert on diabetic foot infections there, the person on the island that sees all those, and he has a little 5-minute clip that makes 2 points about what's the most important thing to change about your practice. We were shocked to find most people didn't take aspirin if they had diabetes and heart disease there. Why? Because no one really does it. Even though it's in our recommendations, we went around a month after people were using the guide, they didn't change their practice, but we got the local diabetes expert to do a 5-minute video saying aspirin is what we should do, and people changed their practice because someone locally said, you know, you should really change. It's not because of study A and B or because this outside guide was made and developed. So I thought those were important things in addition to the content. So in closing, our first international guide was done, obviously, with a lot of collaborators, both at JAPIGO and the CDC, but also under the auspices of the PEPFAR program. And many people also contributed to this guide, especially Joel Gallant, Paul Pham, who actually did most of the authoring of this, along with a number of colleagues in the Zambian Health Ministry, namely Jabin Mulanda, who was also very instrumental at improving the whole project. So thanks very much.